This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. After living through what has come to be called the American century, experts tell us that our reign is about to come to an end. This century, they say, will come to be known as the Chinese century, as China rises to economic superpower status. That means it will be China, not us, calling the shots around the globe. But not everyone agrees with that scenario, and one of those people is our guest today. Timothy Beertsen founded and ran Crosby Financial Holdings, at the time the largest independent investment bank in the Far East. He's become a sought-after speaker around the world, and as a permanent resident of Hong Kong, he has an up-close view of China, how it operates, and the reality of life there. He calls that nation a stumbling giant. That is also the name of his book, which delineates the threats to China's future. Timothy Beertsen joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington in advance of an appearance in Charlotte at noon tomorrow at the Hilton City Center on behalf of the World Affairs Council of Charlotte. Tickets to that event are still available, and you can get more information at our website, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. Welcome.
Thank you.
We've heard so many times from so many different sources about the ascendancy of China and that nation taking our place. We know how much of our debt that they hold. We've seen stories about the infrastructure that they're building, entire cities, in fact, and their rising middle class. And we all just assume that the Chinese century is inevitable, but you say otherwise. And I'm wondering if you are a lone wolf or do others agree with you?
Well, the literature on the subject of China's rise is surprisingly limited, considering how much is written in the media about it. There actually aren't a lot of books on the subject. But if you look at the literature, 90% of the books that are written suggest that China will eventually become the next superpower after the United States. The titles range from, on the one hand, When China Rules the World, to, at the other extreme, The Coming Collapse of China. And by the way, that book was written in the year 2000, so you can make a judgment on it. I'd like to feel that my book is fairly squarely in the middle of the range of literature. I feel that China has a number of very major problems in front of it, but it does have the capacity to address most of them. The question is whether it will or not. So that's what my book deals with.
And do you think it will?
I think that the analysis that this current leadership has made of China's problems is very similar to the analysis that the previous leadership of China made, fairly accurate, but unfortunately the previous leaders didn't follow it up by taking the right action. So what we're looking for isn't the words, what we're looking for is whether the new leadership of China will actually follow up its analysis by taking the right actions.
China has made incredible changes in its government, in its society, in the way it runs the country, in its economic views. I remember back in leading up to the handover of Hong Kong from British rule back to China in 1997, people with these dire predictions of what would happen to Hong Kong and the people who lived there and the businesses that were then located there when China finally took over. None of that came to pass. And in fact, in that time, when the time since, it appears that mainland China has adopted the economic approach and some of the societal freedoms of Hong Kong. I could be wrong about that, but that's what it appears like, which has helped lead China to its powerful presence today. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Well, certainly it's not Hong Kong that's gone through a period of change. It's very much China. The last 30 years, China has reported growth averaging 10% a year. We've got to make the point that all data in China are very frail. We shouldn't take numbers very seriously, but what we do know is that China has grown enormously, lifted a lot of people out of poverty, and changed its society for the better.
But why did they take that path? Why did they emulate what had happened in Hong Kong and move it to the mainland, as opposed to just making Hong Kong what the mainland was at the time?
Because the system could not continue as it was. The situation was really quite dire economically, and change was needed. And what we've seen is a lot of reform over the last 30 years, But you could argue that that was the low-hanging fruit and that the reforms that should be undertaken now are going to be much more costly and difficult, mm-hmm. and that makes it much harder for leaders to implement them.
But to go from the kind of world that Chairman Mao had created in China to what they have today, it seems, took bravery on the part of the leaders. It took a great deal of energy and a great deal of, planning. I don't think it just happened without planning. What does that portend about their ability to do what they need to do, in your view, to become a superpower, the world's only economic superpower?
Well, certainly, Mike, to take a quarter of the world's population from almost a communist system to a very market-driven system, not entirely a capitalist system, but a fairly market-driven system, is certainly the largest counter-revolution in human history. That's very impressive. But we have to reckon that the people that did that were predominantly Deng Xiaoping and the leaders around him, people who'd participated in a revolutionary war, which they'd won. Now the leaders of China are people who've come up through a more bureaucratic background, and it's much harder for them. They don't have the same charisma, they don't have the same sense of authority, and therefore it's much more difficult for them to make radical reforms to their country.
So would you say that their government is in some ways weaker than the government that helped make that transition?
Much weaker. There are very many people who are involved in political decisions in China. You could say, ironically, that one of China's problems might be that it's not a dictatorship. Hmm. There are probably over 1,000 people who have a say in where China's going to go. And a lot of those might have an economic interest in keeping things the way they are. That makes it much harder for the president, the prime minister, to just go out and reform the country.
How has this transformation of China from a strictly communist, Maoist way of life to what it is today, how has it changed the people of China?
Well, a large number of them have been able to become very rich. I think there are something over 200 US dollar billionaires in China today. But the overall standard of living of the country has gone up. The average person is much better off. But there are casualties. There are people who simply can't find employment in today's China because they're older, they're not trained and equipped for it. There are hundreds of millions of casualties in China, but overall, the society is a lot better off.
How was it that some people became super rich? Who were these people before the revolution, essentially, these super rich people today? Were they high apparatchiks in the Communist Party, or did they bring something to the table that was extraordinary in terms of what the needs of the country were that when it was going through this transformation? Who are these people?
There are two very different categories. The majority are people who were perhaps local officials or relatives of local officials who managed to buy businesses at a time a little bit like Russia's history, mm-hmm. when businesses were being sold off, things became available, and perhaps they took advantage of their situation. And, of course, the advantage of being able to get bank credit, which is not widely available in China. On the other hand, there are people out there who simply started businesses and have been very successful at identifying quite basic needs in a society which often had no choices for people. If choices had been able to be made available by entrepreneurs, the public has often responded very well. So there are two very different kinds of rich people in China, some who earned it and some who didn't.
The cover of your book, Stumbling Giant, has two photographs, one at the top of four elderly men sitting on a stoop, and at the bottom of the dust jacket is a photograph of what most of us know China to be now, and at least in terms of what they're building, these sparkling, magnificent New York City-type high-rise cityscapes. And that, I guess, is on the cover because it points out the dichotomy in China, the fact that they are building these enormous forward-looking cities, and one of their major problems, as you point out, is a demographic outlook of what you call remorseless aging. One quarter of the population of Shanghai is over 60. How will this impact China going forward?
Well, the first point I should make is on that cover, those two photographs, the one of Shanghai today with sparkling glass towers and the other of the old men on a bench. The picture of Shanghai with the sparkling towers is China's past, and the four old men is China's future.
Wow. that's what you mean then by remorseless aging. How can that be?
Well, let me say that the biggest challenge that China faces is demographic, and that comes in four shapes. The first is that China's had a fast-growing labor force and unchanged wages for a long time, and it's been able to compete and become the cheapest place in the world to make almost everything. That situation has stopped. Because the number of births has come down, the labor force is no longer growing, and wages are now rising at double digits. China's becoming uncompetitive and needs to find a new business model. Mm. And that will have to be high technology, and China is failing to succeed so far in making that transition.
Why?
Because it doesn't have the capacity to innovate. Chinese people have been very successful in Silicon Valley, but they don't show a lot of sign of being successful at home, and there are structural institutional reasons for that. And I suggest we need to look at the education system and the way in which innovation is pursued in China. But that's the first challenge. The second challenge, as you quite rightly say, is that we have 100 million people in China over 65 today. By 2030, we're going to have 300 million. That's not the issue. It's not the tripling of the over 65s. It's that combined with the fact that the family is becoming atomized. Now a typical couple in China will have four parents alive and maybe eight grandparents alive. And yet they'll have no siblings. And so the pressure to look after older people is becoming intense for Chinese families. So the traditional way of looking after people at home no longer works. Mm. At the moment, 1% of the over-65s are in institutional care. I suggest by 2030 it'll be 50%. And therefore, that change, when you're tripling the number of over-65s, means we go from having to look at the state, having to look after a million old people, to the state perhaps having to look after 150 million old people. This is in a society which has a very, very limited budget. Now, in America, the budget is 30% of GDP. In China, it's 20%. Mm. This is a small government. And I suggest in the book that perhaps by 2030, China may have to weigh up agonizing budget decisions like, do we build care homes for 150 million people, or do we have six more aircraft carriers? The third challenge is gender disparity. The last 20 years, people have had six male children for every five female children. And what that means is the next two decades, there are going to be 50 million men in China who will not have a wife. And this will lead to rising crime statistics and eventually to social instability.
I want to come back to that. We have to take a break. I want to come back to that because that's an important point that I've heard you make elsewhere in the past about the gender disparity. It's the most extreme of any country, probably, you say, in history. Timothy Beardson, our guest, author of Stumbling Giant, The Threats to China's Future. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Boatsman Gilmore Wagner, certified public accountants helping companies achieve their financial goals with offices in the Charlotte and Huntersville Lake Norman areas. BoatsmanGilmoreWagner.com. And from NS2, presenting New Year's Eve with the Avett Brothers and guest Shovels and Rope at Time Warner Cable Arena in Charlotte, Tuesday, December 31st. Tickets available at noon, Friday at Ticketmaster.com. Well, in late 2002, Mecklenburg County adopted the Public Art Ordinance, and the city followed suit quickly thereafter. It sets aside 1% of capital improvement funds for public art. In the 10 years since those ordinances were passed, 67 pieces of public art have been completed or are in progress. But some public art, indeed the idea of it, is often controversial. We're going to look at what constitutes public art, its impact, and more tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, each year, 2 million people contract antibiotic-resistant infections and 23,000 die. New efforts to curb the overuse of antibiotics in animals and people.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this morning and every weekday morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on listener-supported public radio. We're 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Timothy Beertson, founder of Crosby Financial Holdings, at the time the largest of... I'm going to get this wrong if I don't look it up here. the largest independent investment bank in the Far East when it was founded in the late part of the last century, the 20th century. He's written a book about what's coming in the 21st century. Most of us think that China is going to eclipse the U.S. He does not believe so. And his book about this is called Stumbling Giant, The Threats to China's Future. One of the things that you mentioned just prior to the break is this gender disparity that China is going through. There are, and there will increasingly be, more women than men, and you just said that that means in the coming decades, many Chinese men will go unmarried. Many people will say, okay, so what? But you see this as a significant problem. Why?
There will be something like 50 million unmarried men over the next 20 years. And that is already beginning to show up in crime statistics in the major cities of China. Women tend to play quite an important role, surprisingly, in marriage. They have choices, and they tend to marry men who are more affluent, more intelligent, even perhaps better looking. So what we're going to see is not one in six men not having a wife. It's going to be something like one in 2.5 men who are poorer, less intelligent, less good-looking, who are not going to have a wife. And a lot of these men are going to be coming to the cities. And this is a recipe for social instability. And there's really nothing we can do in the sense that those men are born. It's going to happen. The question is, what's the state going to do about it?
But is there a tradition of that kind of activity in China? It seems to me that China has, for centuries, marched in lockstep with the leadership. Would they suddenly become rabble?
First of all, yes, there is a history of it. At various points in China's future, there has been an excess of men over women. Mm-hmm. And that's partly the Confucian heritage, where people prefer to have boys rather than girls, mm-hmm. and often will take some steps to try and ensure that that's the case.
Exactly.
So it's not surprising that the problem is one of scale, that we're looking at such a large number in society which is becoming increasingly urban, and therefore the problem will be more apparent and more pressing because it'll be in the cities.
And how much of the problem with aging that China faces is due to their one-child policy that was in place for so long?
Well, the aging is partly a result of improvements in medicine. Okay. I mean, China now has the longevity of Hungary. It doesn't have that of the United States or Switzerland, but it's been growing. But the one-child policy, surprisingly perhaps, has had no effect whatever on China's rate of births. And the reason why I say that is that although it's well policed, it's certainly enforced, is that it came in 1979, and at that point China's birth rate had already fallen by 50%. Since the policy came in, it's continued to fall, but only at the same speed as the rate of birth has fallen in Hong Kong, Singapore, Korea, and Taiwan, which don't have a one-child policy. So what I would suggest is that the rate of birth has come down in China for the same reason as its neighbours, because of social conditions such as urbanisation. People going from the rural areas to the cities tend to have fewer children. That's a worldwide phenomenon. When you have more women in the workforce, when people get married later, as is happening in China, they have fewer children. This has been what has had the effect. But what I'd like to say is that the fourth demographic challenge, the one we haven't come to yet, mm-hmm. I think is the most important one, and that is that China's population overall is still slowly growing. But by the 2020s, we're going to see certain things happen. by about 2027, China will be overtaken by India to become the biggest country in the world. By the end of the 2020s, every forecast there is suggests that China's population will peak at round about 1.4 billion. And that's because the fertility rate of China at the moment is 1.7 children per couple, whereas the rate of replacement is 2.1. So you can do the arithmetic and roughly work it out. And all the demographers reckon that it'll peak at the end of the 2020s. So not far from now, 15 years or so. But what will then happen is the subject of some debate. Everyone reckons the population will fall. The most benign forecast is the United Nations that suggests that China's population by the end of this century will fall by one-third. The more robust, independent forecasts suggest that the fall could be anywhere up to two-thirds, bringing China's population down to roughly the equivalent of what the United States population is likely to be at the end of this century. In other words, today we have 4.5 Chinese for every one American. Mm-hmm. By the end of this century, it could even be 1-1.
And why is that a problem?
Well, the implication of a sustained fall in population for China for several decades is that I can't think of any society in history which has had that situation and has at the same time been able to maintain consistently high economic growth rates. Mm. Therefore, I would suggest that by the time we get to the 2030s, people will say that if China has achieved an economic growth rate of 2%, they will have done very well.
Wow. Let's talk about economics, because that seems to be where a lot of Americans' concerns over China rest. One of our listeners, Jeff, writes us on Facebook that America has her problems, but I think the predictions of China overtaking us will be about as accurate as the one saying Japan was going to be the world's largest economy a few decades ago. And if people recall, a few decades ago, Americans were very concerned about all the real estate in New York and other big cities that Japan was buying up, and that was going to be the end of us. China holds an enormous amount of U.S. debt. That's where we are concerned about China's control over us. Where did the money that they lent us come from?
Yes, $3.5 trillion of foreign exchange reserves makes China appear to many people to be a very strong country. Mm-hmm. Within that, a lot of it is U.S. public debt, and as you say, that makes them one of the larger holders. They hold approximately 8% of all U.S. public debt. So that's important, yes. However, how did they get there? You've got to look at how China creates foreign exchange reserves. It creates them in two different ways. The first is that Chinese companies export every year more than they import overall, and therefore they accumulate foreign exchange, mm-hmm. which they're required to sell to the central bank in exchange for local currency. The second way that China makes foreign exchange is that it intervenes in the foreign exchange markets every day, as many governments do. China would say it's to stabilize their currency. America says it's to manipulate their currency. Mm-hmm. But the point is they're in the markets every day, and what they're doing most of the time is they're selling Chinese currency and buying foreign currency, usually the dollar. So at the end of the year, they accumulate a lot of foreign currency through those two methods. But of course, both of them require them to spend Chinese money to acquire foreign money. So how do they get the Chinese currency? The answer is that is twofold. First of all, they issue bonds to insurance companies, banks, the public, local currency bonds to raise Chinese currency. And the second way they get the money is that they ask all the banks that operate in China to place prudential reserves with the central bank, which is not an unreasonable point of view. So if they've got $3.5 trillion of foreign currency, they've got something like $3 trillion of domestic debt. And I would suggest that doesn't make China particularly strong. It makes it rather vulnerable, because every 10% rise in the Chinese currency is a $300 billion loss on its foreign exchange assets. And of course, the rate it gets on US Treasuries is a lot less than the rate it pays to borrow currency in its own country. The estimate is that it loses something like $66 billion every year on the interest rate spread. So you could look at China and say, rather than being a strong country, it may constitute the world's largest undiversified and totally leveraged currency hedge fund.
So why do they do it that way?
Because they're very interested in keeping some stability in their currency. And of course, many countries are. They do it in different ways. Mm-hmm. Some might print money. China doesn't particularly believe in printing money. They're worried about inflation. America manipulates its currency because it manipulates its interest rates, which affects its currency. Britain, Japan, Switzerland are all manipulating their currencies. China just does it in a different way. But I would suggest the situation has got out of control and needs to be wound down in some way, and it will not be easy. It's rather like America trying to wind down its quantitative easing program. It won't be easy.
You have extensive background as an investment banker, so you understand all this money stuff that most of us really don't have a very accurate grasp of. Let me ask you, would you be concerned as an American citizen, if you were an American citizen, would you be concerned that China holds so much of our debt? Would you be concerned that someday, without warning, they could call the debt?
A lot of it is two-year treasury bills, which are continually running out, and China, by and large, is replacing them by acquiring the same equivalent when it's issued. They haven't actually been increasing or decreasing for quite a long time what they hold. Their position has been round about 8%, with very little increase or decrease now for about 3 or 4 years. They don't particularly want to wreck the market because they've got $3 trillion at stake, not all in U.S. treasuries, but quite a lot, over $1 trillion. And it's not in their interest to wreck the situation, but I don't think they want to substantially increase their exposure.
Something else is going on in China that's relatively an amazing phenomenon, and we've seen several stories of this on American television. 60 Minutes, which is a major news magazine, has done several stories on the incredible cities that China is building on what used to be farmland, evicting the peasants and building these towering, majestic, glass, glittering cities, which are by and large absolutely, completely empty. They are devoid of people. Why are these cities being built? Simply to give work to people to build them?
Well, as always, there are a number of different factors at work here. But the Chinese government believes that urbanization is the way to go, and so they are strongly encouraging people to move from the rural areas to the cities. This is partly because there are a lot of underemployed people who are not necessary in the farm areas, and they could be generating income in factories. Urbanization, I think, has its drawbacks, its problems, and I don't think China's paid enough attention to that. But of course, if you try and develop your urban planning entirely by state fiat rather than by letting market forces prevail, you will end up with white elephants. I mean, that's the way things go. So we've got a number of cities where the population simply hasn't gone to live, and we've got others which have been a great success. It's been hit and miss. But of course, local officials do make quite a lot of money personally and for their city by developing farmland into urban real estate, and there's a lot of corruption involved. But also, you've got to realize that the local areas within China have very little source of income and yet quite large social expenditures to support, and therefore for them developing urban real estate is a very important part of their income stream.
But a lot of people can't afford to live in those apartments that they're building.
Yes. That's right. But obviously, housing developers have some idea about Chinese society. And of course, a lot of those apartments are bought as second or even third homes by people who do have money. So you don't have to look at the average salary of China and relate it to the cost of an apartment. You just have to look at how many rich people there are and how many apartments they wish to buy. So a lot of people aren't in the market for buying real estate.
But do you need to build whole cities where cities never existed for rich people to have a second or a third home? It doesn't mean to, doesn't seem, at least from our point of view, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
No, this is part of socialist urban planning. Okay. I mean, as I suggested earlier, mm-hmm. you get a lot of white elephants because people in China like big projects, the biggest dam in the world, the biggest this. Mm-hmm. A lot of these projects have actually in practice failed. Either they fail the country environmentally or they fail the country financially or socially. And of course, one of the things that's happening as a result of this confiscation of rural land for urban development is that it causes huge unhappiness amongst the rural population. And when we look at the fact that up until 2010, China was having something like 180,000 large-scale riots a year, a lot of this is because of what's happening to rural land. The other main reason is pollution, which is widespread in China, mm-hmm. pollution of the oil, of the water, the land, and also the air. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of problems that are making people unhappy, although the overall direction of the country has actually gone quite well.
China has gone from a communist society where everybody worked for and lived for the state to a consumer economy, which is an amazing transformation. Are the Chinese people, the workers, not the rich, the workers, are they spending? And if they're spending, what are they spending their money on?
Well, again, one of the problems in China is that the data are very frail. So most numbers you see, you have to treat with great caution. Even the government doesn't really know the data for whole areas of the economy. But the Asian Development Bank did a report the other year saying that 50% of China is now middle class. Well, I would contest that. Looking around at China, I would say that's simply not the case. But the way they define it is that if you can afford a mobile telephone, if you can afford white goods, if you can afford something else, you are by definition a middle-class person. Mm. Well, of course, some of these things are surprisingly cheap in China compared with their equivalent cost in the United States or in Europe. So on their argument, of course, they're right. But a lot of those people don't have very nice clothes, they don't lead a particularly nice life. You wouldn't necessarily call them middle-class in the United States. So a lot depends on the terms you use and how you measure. But spending is actually a surprisingly small part of the economy. And one of the reasons is that people hold back a lot of their money because there is an inadequate provision of social services. You might think of China as being a sort of socialist country, but there is very weak health care, very weak pension provision, very weak unemployment pay. And so people hold back and save furiously. And they're even asked to pay for education.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back with more of the problems facing China, which may hold them back from eclipsing the United States in the 21st century. Timothy Beardson, our guest, his book is called Stumbling Giant, The Threats to China's Future. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Audi of Charlotte, presenting a selection of luxury vehicles committed to customer service and satisfaction. East Independence Boulevard, inside the 485 Beltway. Audi, truth in engineering. Information at audiofcharlotte.com. And Theater Charlotte, presenting Gypsy, the musical of a stage mother willing to go any lengths to transform her daughters into stars. Now through Sunday, tickets at carolinatix.org. Every year, 2 million people contract antibiotic-resistant infections, and 23,000 die. We're going to be talking about the threat of a post-antibiotic age and new efforts to curb the overuse of antibiotics in animals and people on the Diane Lim Show at 10 o'clock this morning. Our guest today, Timothy Beardson, is appearing tomorrow at noon at the Hilton City Center. There are still tickets available. You can go to our website, wfae.org/charlottetalks, for information about that. And that is also where you can go to start a conversation with us, as well as 704-926-WFAE.
WFAE has a challenge for you. Last spring, you eliminated 4 days of our fund drive by responding to our request to pledge early. We want to do it again and are encouraging you to pledge early to help shorten the upcoming fall pledge drive. Every dollar brought in before the drive will go towards the goal of $550,000. And for every $55,000 we raise, we eliminate a day. Pledge your support today at WFAE.org. Thank you for investing in public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Timothy Beertsen is our guest, a stumbling giant, the threats to China's future. His book, he lives in Hong Kong, has been there for decades, founded and ran for years the largest independent investment bank in the Far East, Crosby Financial Holdings, until the bank was sold. You mentioned a few minutes ago that wages in China are rising, which has implications for their broad economy and also for manufacturers, because a lot of things are being made in China because the labor is cheap. When the price goes up because the wages are going up, manufacturing tends to move on to someplace else. What will this mean for China going forward, and why are wages rising?
Well, the book is about the challenges that China's going to face this century. Mm-hmm. We talked about demography, and for me, that's the biggest problem, and that is the one which is very difficult to resolve. I call it insoluble. Mm-hmm. But the other challenges that China has are very important, but all of them can be addressed, given some attention. And the issue that we're seeing is in the economy is that China needs to make this transition from being a cheap manufacturer, which no longer works when wages are going up so rapidly as they are in China. What China has to do is to become an innovation-driven economy. Unfortunately, we're simply not seeing that happen. 83% of the high-tech exports that come out of China are actually made by foreign companies in China, not by Chinese companies. The government is really trying to drive innovation through, but I would suggest that it has the wrong targets. It looks at things like patent application, but not patent grants. It doesn't look at the quality of the patents or the commercial applicability of those patents. It's too much driven by numbers. Also, it looks at the spending that is done on research and development, but actually not who does it, why they do it, and where it's going to lead to. Mm. And too much of it is being done by state enterprises rather than by the private sector companies in China. So there are a lot of things that aren't right, and therefore we're getting the wrong results in China. But this can be changed.
So to move to an innovative economy, to move to what you see, what you call a knowledge economy from where they are today, which is what you say they need to do and what they're trying to do, I suppose, a lot hinges on the style and quality of the educational system. How would you describe their educational system?
Well, if we look at the university system, China does not have one university in the top 100 in the world. And this is extraordinary for the second largest economy. China has built, over the last 8 years, one new university every 3 days. But the problem is that these are not very good universities. Mm-hmm. It's the focus on number rather than quality all the time. And to give an example, China has, forget the official statistics, the reality is that 45% of graduates, when they leave university, will be unemployed. The average salary of a graduate who does get a job is now below that of a migrant labourer. This is not a functional university system for a high-tech economy. We need to see radical change, and I suggest that probably half of China's universities should be closed down and money should be invested in the other half to make them a lot better.
I also heard a speech that you made recently about the, and this is one of the topic points that you made in the speech, that when you go to take your final exams in these Chinese institutions, educational institutions, that they don't ask you to demonstrate any critical thinking skills. They ask you to demonstrate that you know the answer to the question, and there is an answer to the question. That doesn't seem to me to be a way to turn out people who can be innovative.
Yes, I think that critical thinking is vital if we want to encourage innovation in the sciences. But there are various problems to this. As you say, the tradition in Chinese culture, and this isn't particularly a communist thing, it's just a long-term tradition in China, is rote learning. It's learning the data. Whereas in the Anglo-Saxon world, our focus is on teaching people how to think. The data will always be coming along, but we need to know how to think, because then we can apply that to any situation. In China, they focus on learning the data, and there's only so much you can accumulate, and it's changing anyway.
And do you need to learn it in an age of Google?
Well, you can argue that. But also, I think if you're in a society where the authorities would prefer that there's not too much focus on critical thinking about politics or history, then it's difficult to encourage critical thinking in other areas like the sciences.
Let me share with you some things that have come in on the web since we've been talking. Gary says, at last, a voice of sanity. Mr. Beardson has confirmed what I have felt all along. An increasing population leads to a fall in wages. A decreasing population leads to a rise of wages. You can argue which is worst, but a constantly rising world population will lead quite possibly to calamity of some sort. When I was born in 1949, America's population was slightly less than half of what it is today. But if you wanted to work, you could find work. Now the jobs are disappearing. You could live on your pay. Pay is going down today. Why? The population is rising. Too many people chasing too few jobs. It forces the pay scale down. But as a good historian will tell you, the first lesson of history is that nothing is learned from it. We will learn this. Will we learn this time before it's too late? I would say that, as a good historian might say, we won't learn from this either. I don't know how that relates to your book, but there it is.
Well, what I would say is that increasingly what we've seen in China, for example, the last 20 years, is that there used to be a very close relationship between the growth of the economy and the growth of jobs. But that has become less and less and less the case, to the point that today what the economy does has almost no relevance to the creation of jobs. And that's partly because people invest in capital equipment. So you could double the output of a factory without creating one more job.
And that's happening around the world, actually. Huck on Facebook says, does forced labor exist in China? I've heard of suicides in labor camps where people are required to work for companies like Apple.
It's not forced labor as far as producing goods in factories for Western companies. But where you see forced labor is, yes, in labor camps. I write about this in the book. You get the most extraordinary situations where prison guards oblige people to try and create virtual currency on the internet. Spending hours and hours at night creating currency through video game work. The other area where you see forced labor is China's extraordinary footprint in Africa, which in many ways is actually very helpful to Africa. The idea that we don't really want to give charity, we actually want to trade and invest, is a message the Africans quite like. But when you look at the projects that China engages in Africa, like building a highway, virtually in a high proportion of those times, they will ship in labor from China rather than employ Africans. And you wonder why that is. A lot of the times, that labor from China is actually convict labor from Chinese prisons.
Okay, let me take a phone call here. Pete in Charlotte, welcome. You're on WFAE.
Thanks for having me. Question for something that your guest alluded to earlier is the population decline and the demographic problem that will occur starting at the end of the 2020s. And it seems to me America, you know, could have gone the same way, except for, at least in the past 40 years, with the technological economy on the rise, immigration has been the key. It solved the demographic problem in America. So we had enough workers to generate growth. Does he anticipate, or do you anticipate, China aggressively changing their immigration policy to attract workers?
Well, I think there are two different things. One is the policy and one is the culture. and on China welcomes immigration amongst executives or people with technical skills and doesn't really welcome immigration at the labour end of the market because it feels it's got enough of that. So America tends to have roughly the same number of people at the technical end and at the labour end of immigration, but China really only is interested at the top end. But it has nowhere near the sort of number of people that something like 600,000 foreigners live in China, as opposed to, I think, 34 million foreigners who live in America. So the other issue, it's not so much policy of China, but China would quite like to have more technical people coming in, but the culture of China is not necessarily one that welcomes immigration, in the same way that Russian culture doesn't welcome people from other cultures to go and live and work in Russia. So I think that it's unlikely that that culture is going to change. I don't see that we're going to be looking at millions and millions of foreigners going to live in China. And a point I make in the book is that if Beijing is going to be the next Rome or London, the next major international city, you'd expect to be seeing cooks and poets and scientists from all over the world going to live in Beijing. And you just don't see it. It's not happening.
And I would say, I've never been there, but I would believe that Beijing must be a very different city from Hong Kong. Has the character of Hong Kong changed substantially since the British turned it over to China?
No, but then we didn't really expect that because the deal was that the locals would run it. And of course, as in the British time, no money changes hands. So taxes that are raised in Hong Kong are spent on infrastructure in Hong Kong. Okay. And that hasn't changed. The legal system continues to be the Anglo-Saxon system. So we haven't really had changes except we've had rising pollution, as perhaps might be happening all over the world. But there hasn't really been any material change.
Thank you for your call, Pete. One troubling area of China that we hear a lot about in the West is their activities with cybercrime, with hacking. You call it their undeclared war going on in cyberspace. We know of at least incidents that have been attributed to hacking from China under the sponsorship of the Chinese government. Why would a country quickly rising to the top of the world pecking order, and one which we owe so much money to, why would they be attacking computer systems here?
Well, I think we have to divide cyber activity up. I mean, for spying on other people, which essentially we have to accept is done by virtually every government in the world. And, of course, it's been in news in the United States that spying on people is not uncommon within the US. And I can tell you that France spies on its neighbours in Europe. I think we have to just accept that's the way of the world. But China does a lot of it and technically could be the leader at cyber capability, and that's actually quite important because it has military application as well.
Yes.
But I used to feel that if China's spying actually involves breaking into the Pentagon and not just lifting the information, but actually closing down the email systems for several days, or breaking into the State Department and damaging the internet structure, then there was a degree of damage and sabotage, which goes beyond spying, so perhaps there's a qualitative difference. But then along came Stuxnet, where it's strongly believed that the United States and Israel tried to damage the computer systems in Iran. But also, of course, there was collateral damage to a whole lot of third-party countries in that exercise.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't really say that only China damages other people. There are other people that damage them. So it's very difficult to draw the moral lines here. I think there have been attempts to create a Geneva Convention for cyber war. What are the things you can do and can't do? But rather like spying, nobody really wants to put their hand up and say, well, you know, this is okay, we do this, but that's not okay. So it's been very difficult to get any kind of Geneva Convention. If things lead to people dying, that would be obviously qualitatively rather different. And we found Chinese logic bombs on the American electricity grid. Well, that could affect hospitals. So maybe we're edging towards the ability to try and make distinctions, but it's very gray.
So they have serious economic problems. They have serious, serious gender and demographic problems. They have an educational problem that they have to solve. You call the country an ecological disaster. It's not just air pollution. It's water pollution. It's overgrazing of farm animals and more. And you believe that China has about a 20-year window of opportunity to make an economic breakthrough. What would that breakthrough consist of, and why is it a 20-year window of opportunity? I have about a minute and a half. Here.
Yeah. Well, with the economic growth rate declining between now and the 2030s, China, I suggest, has to make the radical reforms that are necessary for it to continue to grow while it still has the funding to do it. And therefore, while it's still growing at 6%, 5%, it needs to address those issues. And what worries me is there's not enough sense of urgency amongst policymakers in China to address these soluble issues, but yet important issues, quickly enough. That's the concern.
Now, a lot of countries, including our own, have these environmental, monetary, educational, demographic, cultural changes that we have to face in the next part of the century. Is it more challenging for them?
Yeah, what I try and do in the book is look at the scale, the severity, and compare it with other countries. Because, of course, China is a much bigger country, so you expect to have more problems. But the scale, proportionately, is much, much more for a lot of these issues than it is in any other country.
Timothy Beardson, his book is called Stumbling Giant, The Threats to China's Future. Thank you very much for the hour. I appreciate it.